This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM, by mobile app, and on the web at kexp.org. My guest this morning is Terry Tempest Williams. Terry is the award-winning author of 15 books, including Refuge, An Unnatural History of Family and Place, Finding Beauty in a Broken World, and When Women Were Birds. Her writing has appeared in The New Yorker, The New York Times, Orion Magazine, and numerous anthologies worldwide as a voice for ecological consciousness and social change. Terry Tempest Williams is here to tell us about her most recent book, The Hour of Land, A Personal Topography of America's National Parks, published in 2016 to honor and coincide with the centennial of the National Park Service. Welcome, Terry.
Thank you, Diane. It's so wonderful to be in Seattle again.
It's great to have you here. What is your purpose in writing The Hour of Land?
You know, if I'm being honest, I think that with most of my books, I've been hiding. And The Hour of Land, I feel that I came clean with my lifelong love affair with public lands, particularly national parks.
What led to your personal interest in national parks?
I think growing up in Utah, where we have five national parks and multiple national monuments, I thought Zion, Bryce, Capitol Reef, Arches, and Canyonlands were backyards, our backyard. And, you know, it was 3 to 4 to 5 hours south, and we were in a Red Rock wonderland. If we went north 4 or 5 hours, we were in the Northern Rockies, Grand Teton National Park, Yellowstone National Park. So with a 5-hour radius, national parks were really part of our identity.
What do you mean by the hour of land?
Such a good question, Diane. I think the hour of land is upon us. And more, especially during this election year, we seem to think that our species is the center of the universe. I don't believe that. We are not the only species that lives and dreams and lives on this planet. So I think the Hour of Land asks us to reimagine our place in the world, one species among many.
What led you to choose the 12 different parks you wrote about in your book? What were your criteria?
Well, I think there are those parks that are like skin. Part of that 5-hour radius I was talking about, Grand Teton National Park, chief among them. Not a year of my life has been spent without being in view of the Grand Tetons, not one. I call it my mother park. Brooke, my husband, and I live in the Colorado Plateau just outside Moab in a little hamlet called Castle Valley, and we're right on the edge of Arches National Park and Canyonlands. So Canyonlands National Park is one of the ones I chose. There are other parks that are dear to our family, and I think our national parks are memory palaces. They're generational, and one of those would be Acadia National Park in Maine, one of the most visited parks in the country. Theodore Roosevelt National Park is also a park that I really love, and maybe it has to do with prairie dogs. But whenever I'm in the North Dakota Badlands, I feel this affinity. I feel, for lack of a better word, it's a patriotic landscape to me. And the fact that this was where Theodore Roosevelt said that he was able to develop the kind of character to become president, that makes sense to me. It's where he chose to grieve after the death of his wife and mother. Other parks, we'd never been. Big Bend National Park. If I disappear, Diane, that's where I'll be. I just absolutely fell in love with the exposure of that landscape. And there it is right on the border of Mexico. We watched American children skipping stones to Mexican children across the Rio Grande, ankle deep. And I wonder, is this really what Mr. Trump wants to build a wall in between? Gates of the Arctic, the least visited national park in the system, is also one that I chose. Such a remote, powerful, beautiful place, really reminding us what wildness, what wilderness is. Other parks were interesting to me because of the history. Alcatraz, we don't think about that as part of the national park system, but it is part of Golden Gate National Recreation Area. I went with Tim DeChristopher, who had just been released from prison for bidding on oil and gas leases. Call him a felon, hard to imagine, but there it is. And we went to the Ai Weiwei show, who is also a political prisoner in China. Powerful, powerful stories, and the Indian occupation that occurred in the 1970s. The history is fascinating to me. And I think the park that really confounded me, and I kept going back again and again, was Gettysburg National Battlefield. And I think what I realized was, in so many ways, the war has never ended. We're still a divided nation. And there was a chilling moment with some reenactors, artillerymen, Confederate Army. And I asked them with all sincerity, you know, what was the cause of the Civil War? And one of them turned to me and said, if you think I'm going to say slavery, think again. Slaves, guns, just different items, same issue. States' rights, getting the government out of our lives. Don't tread on me. I realize that's the same rhetoric I'm hearing in Utah that we heard in Malheur National Wildlife Refuge. And I think we're hearing it now, even in our presidential election. So that's the criterion. Those that were familiar, less familiar, new, and historical.
What is the relevance of our national parks in the 21st century? In what ways can they help us?
These are such great direct questions. You know, Wallace Stegner, whom I love and I consider a mentor, he talked about how our national parks are our best idea. I would argue, if he were here, that it is our evolving idea. That in 1916, you have a director like Stephen T. Mather, who was instrumental in establishing Mount Rainier National Park in 1899. His concerns were, how do I build a constituency? And he had to raise a lot of money and held these millionaire dinners. He wanted to get Mrs. Astor to Yosemite. And really, one of his major concerns was, is there a place that is comfortable enough for her? And so the Ahwahnee Hotel was built, ironically named after the very people that were displaced. So we have this shadow history of our parks as well, of displaced people, of having it be a privileged site. I think that's changing, that's evolving. And I admire John Jarvis, who's the director today, who is trying to create more relevancy for diverse audiences, urban audiences. And I think that's happening. Also, to bring children in, every fourth grader can come with her family for free. I would also argue that we have today a Black president, Barack Obama, who was a community organizer, who in 2012 honored another community organizer, Cesar Chavez, and created the Cesar Chavez National Monument in Keene, California, where the United Farm Workers organized. So when you ask what is the relevancy, I think it is an evolving idea. It carries our histories, our shadows, as well as our illuminations. And I have come to see our national parks as breathing spaces in a society who is increasingly holding our breath.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Terry Tempest Williams, author of the book, The Hour of Land, A Personal Topography of America's National Parks. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on listener-powered KEXP, 90.3 FM by mobile app, and on the web at kexp.org. What were some of the forces behind the national parks being established?
You know, one thing I didn't realize is that our national parks were established the same time Indian reservations were being established, which I think is interesting. But, you know, in many ways, our national parks were created out of conflict, out of war. And what was fascinating to me is that really our first public lands were created out of the Yosemite Land Grant Act. And it was Abraham Lincoln, after one of the worst years of the Civil War in the 1860s, who signed that Yosemite Land Grant Act to set aside the Mariposa Grove and the Yosemite Valley. And then we know that in 1872, Yellowstone National Park was our first national park. But I think it was, I like to think that it was a gesture of peace. It was looking ahead at a public commons. And I think that that is still the case. Many, many people took a lot of hard work to create our national parks, to establish these national parks. And I think it's going to take equally rigorous work in order to keep them for the 21st century.
Would you say more about what it takes to establish a national park?
Many of our national parks were established first by the 1906 Antiquities Act, and they've been met with controversy. You know, it's the local people are saying you're pulling the land right out from under us. I know that's certainly been the case in Utah. But someone along the line, usually a local person, coupled with a person of power, a person of means, maybe attached to Congress, because a national park ultimately has to be established through an act of Congress. And it takes years, decades, unless it's an Antiquities Act, and then it can be signed into law by the President of the United States. For example, in Utah right now, the Bears Ears National Monument proposal is before the president on his desk, whereas 25 tribes along the Colorado Plateau, Navajo, Hopi, Zuni, and the two Ute tribes among them, are asking for 2 million acres to be set aside to protect their home ground, where their ancestors' bones are buried, where their ceremonies take place, where their medicines are held. When we talk about an evolving idea, I think this is an exquisite opportunity of a healing between Native people, the government, and even the U.S. National Park Service. I think the same situation we see in the Arctic, in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, to become a monument. Again, with the Gwich'in people raising their voices. What's at stake? These very lands and the people who live there. Why? What was a revelation to me, Diane, is that 40 of our 59 national parks are threatened by oil and gas development. 12 of our national parks already have oil and gas development inside them, with another 30 threatened. So I think the question has to be asked, where is our restraint? And must we develop everything? And I would argue that our greatest use of our public lands is to keep our fossil fuels in the ground and to see our national parks in the 21st century as the closest thing we have to sacred lands. And in so many ways, the Native people are showing us the way.
Would you say more about the threats from fossil fuel extractions to some of our national parks and public lands?
Well, I can tell you, living in Utah, on the edge of Arches and Canyonlands, if you and I were to go up to Island in the Sky, part of Canyonlands, it would appear that our national parks are now annexes for the oil and gas companies. You would see flares, you would see pumps going up and down looking like giant cooties or ravens made out of metal, pipelines being run above the ground because it's so dry. It's devastating, and particularly in a landscape that is very unforgiving. You see that infrastructure. And if we were a living raven to fly over the Colorado Plateau now, over Canyonlands and Arches, it looks like an exposed nervous system. So vast is the infrastructure. That's one example. Another example is Theodore Roosevelt National Park. Right now, there is an oil refinery that is being proposed 2 miles from the viewshed of the southern unit. The Bakken oil fields. I went there with my father and Valerie Naylor, this magnificent superintendent of the park who has since retired. When we were there 2 years ago, 1 million barrels a day were coming out of the Bakken. That is a stone's throw away from Theodore Roosevelt National Park. So those are two examples. Add Yellowstone, add Grand Teton, add Glacier. It takes your breath away. The risks.
Would you speak about the Tempest Exploration Company, LLC?
Yes. On February 16th of this year, my husband and I purchased 2 oil and gas leases at the quarterly BLM oil and gas lease auction sale. I was just talking to a friend today in Seattle. It's $4 a cup for a cup of coffee. We purchased those lands for $1.50 an acre, if you can believe that. And so we now have leases for 1,120 acres. What I need to tell you is the BLM, the Bureau of Land Management, has not given us those leases yet, even though we have paid for them. It was legal. We were absolutely in compliance with the law, even as we're challenging it as conservation buyers. They are questioning our intent. And what we're saying is, you know, there were speculators, wildcatters, landmen among us who were also bidding for those oil leases. We bought ours in the fire sale. So there were no other bidders. We purchased them fair price. And what they're saying is that we have no intent of drilling for oil and gas. But what we're saying is neither do the other bidders until the price of oil goes up. And what we're saying is until science can show us that the oil and gas is worth more above ground given the costs of climate, then we choose to leave that in the ground. So we're hoping that they will give us the leases shortly, and then we will continue to proceed with this learning curve of what it means to be part now of this oil and gas industry in the 21st century.
You are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM by mobile app and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Terry Tempest Williams, author of the book, The Hour of Land, A Personal Topography of America's National Parks. Well, you've already said a bit about this, but would you say more about the meaning of our national parks for Native Americans?
You know, I would never try to speak for Native people, but I've been very moved by the stories that they tell. Jonah Yellowman, a medicine man among them, who lives in Monument Valley, came to visit us not too long ago. And to hear him talk about why these lands matter, why these lands near Bears Ears, which are adjacent to Canyonlands National Park, part of Grand Gulch, Slickhorn Canyon, Owl Canyon, he said, you know, this is where our identity lies. The land is mother. This is where our stories are held, the bones of our ancestors are. We know every plant by name, and we know its usage. And they see the threat with the oil and gas development, and they are asking for those lands to be protected for all time, for their people, here, now, a healing. I should tell you that the lands that we now have the leases on are 14 miles from Arches National Park. And also, the other parcel is very near Ute territory. And some of our Ute friends are eager to help us with prayers on that land. And, you know, their landscape where their ancestors are located, even their paintings on rock walls, is where Dinosaur National Monument is. So almost without exception, Diane, our national parks are deeply tied to Native people. And I think now in this evolving idea, the Native people have a much deeper say about how those lands are interpreted, that it's not one story, but many stories. And I find that encouraging. I should say that also with Bears Ears, with the 25 tribes, the five major tribes that I talked about who are in closest proximity to these wildlands are also asking for co-governance. Same with the Blackfeet in Glacier.
What do you find to be special about national parks that include deserts, such as Canyonlands and Big Bend?
You know, when I think about Big Bend, it was watching javelinas eye shine at night. It was seeing great horned owls in moonlight. It's seeing this explosion of cactus in the spring. It's the natural cycles of a day. It's integrity, awe, wonder, these qualities that I think have shaped our character as American people. And this is an idea that has now stretched around the world. You know, E.O. Wilson, the eminent biologist, has said that if our species is going to not only survive but thrive, half the world must remain wild. And I believe that. And again, that word constraint and restraint. When I think about, you know, what will bring us together in this very divided United States, what could help create a United States of humility? And I think it's our national parks. What has struck me and moved me so deeply in working on this book, The Hour of Land, is that everywhere we go, people are telling stories. I mean, just having come back from Mount Rainier National Park, Bill Brockman and his wife, Mary Jane, they met climbing Mount Rainier. He was raised at Mount Rainier National Park. His father, Frank Brockman, was the first naturalist there. Some of the taxidermy that we saw, that Martin with the grin, you know, probably with his father's. So everywhere you go, you hear these stories of people in place and why they matter. again, memory palaces. Whenever I enter a national park, I meet the miraculous. Golden bears in Grand Teton, Bear 399, who has populated Grand Teton with her bears. Gifts, everywhere you look, gifts, whether it's bison, pronghorn, or a raging sea on the Otter Cliffs in Acadia, or shimmering sawgrass in the Everglades, or northern lights in the gates of the Arctic, or polar bears coming inland in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. Public lands are public commons.
Would you say a few words about the Gambesia, a fish on the endangered species list that inhabits Big Bend National Park in Texas?
You know, I have to tell you, when I was recording the book, I kept talking about the Gambesis. And finally, the engineer said, you've got to stop. It sounds like a mafia family. But this is a minnow, an inch, imagine. And they thought that this minnow was extinct. And then in these two small ponds, maybe the size of this studio, they found them. They were still alive. And it's a great story of naturalists and biologists within Big Bend National Park who really brought them back into being. You know, people would dump tropical fish in those ponds. It would rain. They would overflow. The birds would pick at them. You know, just really a difficult life. But there they are at Big Bend Village in the campground. And it does not seem the sight of this holy pool of blessed water that is carrying these endangered minnows, the only place in the world. You know, that's the other side of our national parks, is they really are holding these lives of other so that they can breathe. Again, as I was saying, and live and dream on the planet. We are not the only species. We are not the center of the universe.
What lessons do parks have to teach us?
You know, I think it's different for everyone. And that's part of the power, is that these lands do hold our natural histories as well as our country's histories. And I have to tell you, you know, I thought I was writing a book about public lands and national parks. I thought it was going to be joyous and easy. It was one of the most rigorous assignments I've given myself. What I also realized is I've written a book about America, both in crisis and in healing. And I think it behooves each of us, in our own way, with our own gifts, in our own time, to protect these public lands as they protect us, reminding us what it means to be human.
What do you see as the true significance of our national parks?
Right now, it just feels to me that it's about open spaces, breathing spaces, a protection of species, grizzly bear, wolves, the longest migration we have in the lower 48 with the pronghorn in the greater Yellowstone ecosystem in Grand Teton, for example. When you look at the southwestern parks, it's a bitten landscape. It's how does one live in aridity? And looking at our deep past with Puebloan pictographs and petroglyphs, I just think it brings us back into alignment with our highest and deepest selves. Or in the case of some of our historical parks, like Gettysburg, I think it gives us insight into why we are still a divided nation. And how do we find a way back to ourselves? I'll tell you a quick story. I was with my father. He loves Popeye chicken, whatever. And we went into that restaurant. We were engaged in a political, I will call it an argument, conversation about climate change, etc. And then I asked this one gentleman who is from Alabama, and we did not agree, as far as I could tell, on almost anything. And I said, what are you doing in Utah? And he said, we've just finished a 3,000-mile pilgrimage to the national parks in Utah and the American Southwest. And he said, this is what our country needs. Our parks are our pathway to peace. We must have talked for 20 more minutes, and I can't tell you how much we had in common. So I think it's a great leveler. And I just loved how he said, you know, nature is what we all have in common, even human nature. And we seem to have forgotten about that. I think our national parks allow us to listen. And if we learn how to listen to the land, we can begin to listen to each other.
Is there a favorite part of your book you'd like to share with us?
Is there a favorite part? You know, I had never heard of Effigy Mounds National Monument, which is on the banks of the Mississippi River in Iowa. So maybe I can just talk about seeing on this one particular path. As we continue down the path, the glare of the Mississippi River shines through the spaces between sugar maples and hickories as it meanders below. The temperature feels cooler, the shadows deeper. Suddenly, with a white oak as my witness, the energy of the woods shifts. In the clearing is the bird. I stop to see the winged effigy in its entirety. Falcon enters my mind. Swift and stealth, what if the wind I have been hearing is the memory of flight? This bird made of earth glimmers as light dances on the leaves, and I want to touch her body, a garden, but I don't. Restraint is its own prayer. The fact that a red-headed woodpecker, now iridescent in sunshine, flies down from an oak branch to where the raptor's heart would be only makes the moment more miraculous. These effigy mounds, sacred to the Ho-Chunk people, remain, not plowed under. Here, now, for the rest of the afternoon, I walk the effigy's wings into motion. They say her wingspan is more than 200 feet. For me, her wingspan time, where the whispering of holy wisdom can be heard. Great bird above the great river, what would you have us know?
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Go out. You know, I just think that in this centennial year of our national parks, this is the hour of land. And each of us can locate the park that speaks to us and find a way, again, each in our own time with our own gifts in our own home ground, of how to protect them.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Terry.
Thank you, Diane. I've loved our conversation.
You are just listening to Terry Tempest Williams, author of the book, The Hour of Land, A Personal Topography of America's National Parks, published in 2016 by Sarah Crichton Books. Sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts, along with KEXP's music podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on demand, and then podcasting. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on listener-powered 90.3 FM by mobile app and on kexp.org.